Coming up next, the booking reads A la recherche du temps perdu. Hey everybody, welcome to The Booking. That's right, we're reading A la recherche du temps perdu by Marcel Proust. I guess that's how you pronounce it.
Probably not.
Almost certainly not. I'm not a French guy. I can pronounce the word baguette. I can say
that's pretty good.
Sweet Paris. I can say, what are other French words I know? Yeah, I know how to laugh.
Oui.
I can say oui. Yes, I forgot about that. I can say oui, oui, monsieur.
No.
I can say no. Yeah. Although the French people are pretty famous for not being able to say no. As you'd see if you read further volumes of this book. But we're only talking about the first part of the first volume today. Cambrai. What was that accent? I sort of wanted to do a French like Cambrai or something, but I started out that way and then I gave up and it came out like Cambrai. Hey, y'all. You want to read some Marcel Proust? Ben. Your name is Ben.
Nathan.
You are person who is on the booking.
So it would seem.
Explain yourself.
I can't.
You can't?
No.
Have you not peered into your own soul? I've dredged up old memories while eating a delicious Madeleine tea cookie or whatever?
You know, Nathan, the memories floated down the river of my soul like moon lilies on a starlit night, whose shadows reminded me of the shadows of my childhood, as it also went by kind of like a river. Yeah.
I've been there, bro.
I know. We all have.
Hey, speaking of bros, we've got the third bro in this room right now, and he needs an introduction.
Apparently, I do, yeah.
He's a man who needs an introduction. So why don't you...
The title of my biography.
A man who needs an introduction. That's a pretty good title for an item ever a biography.
Yeah.
Ben, but who would read it? You need an introduction. If you need an introduction, then I don't know why. Although probably, like if you were to grab Barbara Streisand's biography, she's a woman who needs no introduction, but I bet there's an introduction in there.
I bet so.
I bet somebody wrote an introduction. I bet most biographies and autobiographies have introductions.
Probably.
I like that Barbara Streisand was your pull for the person out there who needs no introduction.
I'll tell you why. It's because she just released a giant autobiography and I saw it at the bookstore. There's a bookstore about 5 minutes from my house, a Barnes and Noble. And I like to go and walk there sometimes if I haven't gotten my steps or something and the kids are in bed, I'll just pop over there and it's a more interesting place to walk than my neighborhood when it's dark. So, you know, I'm kind of familiar with the books that are on the shelves and stuff like that. And Babs wrote a big autobiography and I think she might have written it a while ago, but I don't know. It's like a giant doorbuster of a tomb. Doorbuster of a tomb.
That's amazing.
Eight tomb.
Go ahead. It's a tomb.
It's a tomb. It's a giant tomb.
Yeah.
You guys know about Barbara Streisand's mall?
No.
Are you aware of this?
No.
So Barbara Streisand likes to shop at the mall. I'm pretty sure this is not an urban legend, but this is true. This is like a confirmed fact. She likes to go to the mall, but she cannot do it because she's too famous. She gets mobbed, all this sort of thing. She's a woman who needs no introduction, as we established. So what she's actually done is built like the equivalent of a Simon Mall, fully staffed, in her basement. Like she has a...
What?
A
urban legend. Calling it right now.
I'll bet you a dollar. I'll bet you a Madeleine tea cookie.
I wouldn't know where to find it.
It's a tiny shopping mall. It says it's a tiny shopping mall. What does that mean?
Barbara Streisand, reminder, Barbara Streisand has a mall in her basement. This is in Jezebel.com.
A doll shop, a costume shop, a functioning candy store.
Told you.
You said the equivalent of a fully staffed Simon Mall.
She has.
Those are your words.
You got to admit. Right. Okay, maybe I exaggerated a little bit, but you got to admit, it's still pretty wild that Barbara Streisand has several shops built to look like malls with products that she can go and quote unquote buy and a staff of people that man those shops under her house. Like that is a crazy rich person. Barbara Streisand type thing to do.
It seemed like, just skimming this article, some of them were just like basically just displays.
Yeah.
Not
even there's a picture. It just looks like if you go down to the picture with John Travolta and Jim Brolin, I don't think it's staffed.
Well, fine. Okay, it's not that crazy. It's totally normal.
Yeah. I have a mall in my basement. It's
listen, it's crazy, but
I keep like baby toys and old cardboard boxes like in a display where I can look at them and
let's go to the mall.
I can pretend to buy them. Yeah, that's right, honey. Let's go on a trip.
Yeah, I guess that explains the Korean guy that you've hired to man the kiosk and be like, hey, buy this old piece of cardboard.
That's right. Yeah, you need to come to the mall more often.
I need to come to the mall.
I've got to pay my employees, Nathan.
Yep. You're always yelling at your kids like, you will go to the mall right now. That kind of thing.
Sounds worse and worse.
Okay, fine. I guess that wasn't as cool and interesting of an urban fact as it was in my mind. Barbra Streisand just has some fake boring three-shop mall with a fake boring but fully functioning ice cream parlor.
I've got a Colbert video here. Taking a tour of it.
Okay. We're watching Stephen Colbert, just the most unlikable guy in the world. Don't you guys agree? Just
among them, at least.
Just yeah, such a partisan hack.
He's a hack.
So unfunny. All right. He's walking through Barbra Streisand's stuff. Yeah. I mean, that looks like a mall. There's an
antique shop.
Antique shop.
It just looks like a bedroom.
They're going
now we're going down to the basement. Down a spiral staircase. Yeah, it looks like she's on an old-timey street, and there's an old doll shop.
Let's not undersell this to punish Nathan. There's like...
It's more like if you went... What you would imagine, like a London street with shops or something like that.
Yeah, like what Diagon Alley's pretending to be.
Yeah.
But she's like built the street, and then there are storefront windows and stuff.
Yeah, it's like a very narrow alley street, Diagon Alley type of a situation with like storefront shops, and you can go into the doll shop, and that's where all of her dolls and things are on display. And you can go into the costume shop, and that's where all the costumes and things are on display.
Yeah, not a full staff as far as I can tell, but
yeah, I've not seen any staff yet.
Oh, here's some dogs. Barbra Streisand presumably has staff, like she has people that serve
her.
At her house.
And she's gonna like maybe if she's gonna go down to the candy or ice cream shop, she's gonna have her maid or her
butler or whatever
go down and put on their hat and make the ice cream behind the counter.
Stephen Colbert is doing a hilarious bit. He pulled out a
Bed Babs and Beyond coupon.
Oh man.
Bed Babs and Beyond.
Yeah.
Is that what the coupon was?
Yes, it is what it was.
Well, yeah.
No, I'm not that clever. Only Stephen Colbert is that clever.
That's very true.
Or his writers are.
Only Stephen Colbert and his writers are that clever. Yes, I would agree with that statement. All right, now he's laughing. He's sucking up to Barbara. He's just the most unlikable person in the world. Okay, so I'm glad we've established that. Well, we did it. We did it, guys.
We succeeded.
Barbra Streisand has.
We got to the truth of the matter.
It wasn't quite as exciting as the truth I was imagining, but I think it still has some Stephen Milhouser vibes, maybe some Hollywood gothic. Rich people, eccentric.
Oh, yeah.
Thou too must die, Barbara. Kind of somebody could write a good poem about it, kind of.
Do you know who else keeps an incredible collection of antique memories, Nathan, in the basement of his soul?
Who's that?
His name is Marcel Proust.
I wondered if you might say that.
I think that's false. You want to know why?
Why?
He's dead.
Oh.
Yep. Barbra Streisand's going to be dead soon. We will all die.
Well... Fine. I'm speaking in the present of the reading of the author, as he lives while we read him.
Yes, the character, Marcel, or the unnamed narrator, although people call the character Marcel. But technically, he's the unnamed narrator, although I think in later volumes, the ones published after Proust's death, they do include sometimes where the character is addressed as Marcel, but we don't know that Proust actually would have wanted that if he...
Uh-huh.
And not everything is one-to-one with his life, although most of it is more or less one-to-one. The big thing is that all the love affairs are portrayed as with women, which is, well, we'll get to it. Anyway, we still haven't given an introduction to the man who needs an introduction. Ben, why don't you handle that most pleasant of duties? Mm.
Yes, yes. He has a basement of well-kept antique memories in his soul. Jacob Menzel. The pastor who's a master of...
I have many things in my soul.
Solipsism?
Of solipsism? Yeah, sure. He's solipsistic. Would you agree with me that Jake is the most Proustian of the three of us?
I'm processing that question right now. I don't know.
The person with easiest access to early childhood memories, certainly, and the most likely to like what you. We walked through for some silly reason a Simon Mall with Jake not too long ago, and he was Prousting all over the place. Like,
that is true.
This was the ice cream parlor where I had my first kiss. I was like, that kind of, that wasn't a literal one, but it was like those sorts of, like, he was having a lot of moments. And I've actually had the closest thing to a Proustian moment that I've ever had in my life was in a Simon Mall. And it involved actually walking past a Victoria's Secret. I wasn't doing anything that I shouldn't have done. I just happened to be walking past one, and they were jetting this cheap perfume through it, and this cheap perfume came out and hit my nostrils, and it rocketed me back to high school. It was really crazy. I mean, it was actually like I suddenly remembered all these things that I had totally forgotten. Like, I could picture the girl that I used to sit behind who had that, whatever that lame, bad, fruity kind of
that fragrance.
Fragrance.
Yeah.
It's like she had
it was very fruity in high school. All the girls had very sweet, fruity type of a. And a lot of that was lotions from Bath and Body Works, but yep.
Well, for whatever reason, one of Victoria's secrets that day was that she was using 90s hygienic products, I guess. And it was like I pictured the room, a room that I hadn't pictured for years. I thought of people I hadn't thought of for years. I thought of incidents. I thought of teachers. I just like had like the full thing. And I literally stood there with my feet glued to the stupid mall, like having a moment. And I've never quite, I mean, obviously things trigger memories and stuff like that, but I've never quite had a thing that felt so much like what Proust is describing. Although, of course, as we'll get into, the famous Proustian moment actually doesn't entirely resemble the Proustian moments that we think of as Proustian moments in the novel. But I don't know. Have you guys ever had a Proustian moment like that? You eat something or smell something or get a whiff of something or see something and it just like,
Takes over
and triggers a bunch of stuff.
Yeah. Actually, I had one while I was reading about the Madeleines. And actually, I had forgotten all about, I don't want this to be rehashing all these old memories, but like even there was a moment when he was talking about the bed creaking and the light coming in the window in his old bedroom. And I had totally forgotten about this whole, so many aspects of my childhood live in these sort of like quarantine segments. And one of them are these family reunions we would have in Mississippi every Labor Day. And they live in these quarantine moments because this is like this whole other world. So every Labor Day weekend growing up until I was about 10 or 12, we would go just for the weekend. My whole family and like a lot of my family that lives in Evansville, cousins and things, we go all the way down to Pontotoc, Mississippi, and we'd all pack into my Mama Holloway's house. My great-grandma called her Mama Holloway, and there's so many rich memories. And she had all these bedrooms with these iron beds, and me and my cousins would pack into them, and sometimes you'd get a bed, and sometimes you'd have to sleep on the floor, on the hardwood floors of this old house, and down in Mississippi in September. And I could just, like, I just, like, reading this book has been like that for me, just triggering all these weird things I haven't thought about in years. And I could take probably 20 to 30 minutes to catalog all the things, all the little details that I just suddenly just started like reliving while I was reading the book, down to the little games we used to play and the smell of breakfast in the morning and the adults laughing and playing Uno at night and the porch and the little jar time capsules my cousin Tracy and I would make, and the boat, we'd make boats out of leaves from the myrtle trees and put big.
Maybe. I don't know.
No.
Magnolia?
Magnolia trees.
There you go. Yeah, there you go.
We'd make boats with like sails with toothpicks things. And we'd pack roly polies on them and send them down the gutters. And
nice.
All sorts of stuff like that. Anyhow, I was just reading. It had several things like that happen just in the course of reading this, where it's just like, I'm just going to be like in my own world for, which is why reading the book has been such a challenge to just relive in a lot. That's all.
Yeah. Well, this is one of those books that brings that sort of thing out, which I feel like historically, if somebody had to predict whether we would like this or not on the bookening, they might think we're like the anti-pretension Brigade. We're not big fans of Joyce outside of his short stories, particularly The Dead, but something like Ulysses, we don't have a lot of patience for. Some of these more narcissistic, navel-gazing kinds of things we've been hard on in the past. So I guess it'll be interesting to see what we have to say about Mr. or Monsieur Marcel Proust and his work, but perhaps... If somebody just like has no idea, I don't know why they're listening to this podcast. Probably they ditched us around like hour 10 of
this. There's a way to enable. I'm sorry. That just makes me really angry.
What's that?
It's the whole thought.
The idea that someone would judge us for
liking this.
Yeah.
There's a type of navel gazing that is narcissistic, and there's a type of interrogation of your life and your memories and your childhood that's universal. And the two are very different. And I can see why an idiot would confuse the two, but it's not the same thing.
Yes, I agree. And I don't think that, I think Proust, by being specific, by drilling into the specifics, he's arriving at the universal. And I know that statement in and of itself sounds pretentious.
But it's the truth.
You have a guy who's describing such a specific era, an era with which we have very little in common.
Almost nothing.
And a world that is so...
It's very foreign.
So removed from our world. And by just... drilling into his experience of it, he captures any number of things that are beautifully universal.
I was going to say, I have not had a Proustian moment.
Of that kind? Of
nope.
Like a...
Nope, not a takeover kind of a thing.
None of it. Like,
not that I can think of.
Huh. It's interesting. Well, I think that... I don't know.
I've forgotten it. I have pretty strong memories of a lot of things. And
you're very in touch with your childhood memories.
Yeah.
And feelings, at least.
I am in touch with a lot of memories and feelings. I could pull a lot of stuff. I tend to, I don't know, maybe we all dream about people we know, but I dream about certain eras of my life a lot and about the people in them. But I can't pull just a Proustian kind of...
Yeah, moment. I mean, I would say you guys are probably both more in touch with that stuff actually than I am, even if you haven't had a Proustian moment. Like, I am pretty ruthless, a pretty ruthless mover forward in my life. Like, I do not like to... dwell on the past. I have very few memories of before I was about 10. Once I finish a chunk of my life, then it's done and it's cordoned off, and usually it's gone to crap and it's all painful.
But that's a great recipe
anyway.
For a Proustian moment,
though. Right, exactly. It's like I have all the materials somewhere deep in my subconscious, but I...
And then you just need the right triggers.
So it may well be that Ben, in not having a Proustian moment, is just more in communication with his past Bens.
Well, I will say that as a kid, even as a little kid, I would obsess over friends and people I know and like catalog them in my mind and like kind of hold them dear. Kind of like a kid would hold the stuffed animal dear.
Right.
Just in the same sort of obsessive, like, this is my world. Like, I can't lose my world. I can't lose my people. And I would do that. I did that for a long time as a kid.
That's the kind of thing that constant rehearsal is going to prevent a Proustian moment because it lives with you.
Yeah.
Right. And what you need are access to those memories, but you need some walls that, a smell, a trigger.
And there's probably some of those, but there are. It's not like I remember everything, but...
This maybe sounds self-pitying, but the only era in my life I've really ever liked is this one. So it's like each other area, I'm like, let's wall that off. Goodbye, era. I treat it like, what's the Poe story? Montresor. I bury it alive.
The cask of Amontillado.
I put the wall up and I'm like, goodbye.
Well, that's why... I grew up in Evansville, Newburgh, and I was here for 18 years. And when I turned 18, I went off to college, and then I lived in Bloomington for 18 years. And so then I moved back.
Yep. That's why I say you're the most Proustian, because I can't go anywhere with you in Evansville without you being like, oh, this is where...
Yeah, it's like, well, I have two lives. I have the life I lived here, and then I have the life I lived up there in Bloomington. And now I'm at the forefront of my next life, which is in the same place as my old life. And so everywhere I go, it's like all of the, there are triggers everywhere for all these parts of me or memories or things that I've forgotten or wanted to forget. And a lot of them actually is just like the type of high school memory that you don't want to live with you for X, Y, or Z reason.
Right.
I started my Christian life right around the time I moved to Bloomington. And so I left in some ways, my old sinful life is what I left behind in Evansville.
And so I have a lot of that sort of baggage too everywhere around here. It's the same sort of thing as like, if I were to go to Arizona, I would have a lot of similar things. So every summer, every fall, we'd go to Mississippi. Every summer, we'd go to Arizona with my mom to visit my grandparents, Mesa, Phoenix area. And then with my dad, it would alternate going to Florida or to Delaware. And in Delaware, we would take trips. We'd always go see Longwood Gardens, and then we'd do like Washington, D.C. or Boston or Gettysburg or New York or something like that. So all those things are discrete. Florida has places that can trigger things. Arizona would, if I ever went back. Mississippi does. But these places that like, and I'm sure that we all have like family in other places or vacations or things like that would actually do that.
I think that's true. The other thing I'm kind of thinking as you talk, and again, this could sound pretentious, but for me, it's almost like having an artistic sensibility is at odds with gathering the materials that you need to be an artist. In other words, I've lived my whole life wanting to write or wanting to engaging with books, thoughts, ideas. I know that sounds pretentious, but I'm not saying I'm better than someone who didn't do that. I'm just saying that's how I was. It's like, I've never gotten out of my head enough to actually notice where I am and take stock of the sights and the smells and the people and everything. It's just always like I'm thinking about somewhere, something else when I'm there. It doesn't really matter. I don't have a lot of affection for places in a way that I find is maybe a little alien to a lot of people, like because I'm just always carrying my world around with me, which again sounds super pretentious, but I don't mean that makes me better than someone who doesn't. I'm just saying that's how I am. So it's like, I can remember what book I was reading when I was 10. I can trace a life of ideas.
Yeah.
I can trace a life of sort of personal development. I can trace kind of, but it's almost like if I wanted to really be Marcel Proust, I would have needed to not be that way because I needed to relax and experience a little bit of life before I could, you know, process it into anything. It's like I had a processing machine, but it's taken me forever to gather fuel for it because I was too busy making the machine run instead of going out there and getting the kindling that I needed to actually throw into the stupid machine. Which is, you know, if you're like a young person that's artistic and you're listening to this, go live some life. I guarantee it will make your stuff better. And I know that's annoying and you've heard other people say that, but life, even if you're going to write a fantasy novel or something, life really comes in handy. Anything else you guys want to say before we get to context and stuff? I guess we're talking baggage. That's what this is. In fact, baggage plane flying over right now. It's a little late. I don't know that any of us probably have a lot of actual Proust-related baggage.
No, zero Proust baggage.
I saw a Proust quote or two in Gene Wolfe.
Yes.
And I once started reading this book on like a free Kindle version. And I got as far as the Madeline in the Tea.
That's the money section.
And I liked it. But I just also, it was on my phone, on Kindle, and things easily, even great works of literature and really cool books easily get lost that way.
Right. I have a theory that even the most pretentious works of art tend to live on because they have big juicy hooks that usually involve sex or violence. So like everybody knows Anna Karenina because it's about an adulterous affair. And it happens to also be a wonderful book, but it's got a big juicy hook that makes a person, appeals to their baser nature. And I find that a lot of the things that we actually love and that live through the generations have that. Even Jane Austen, like it's a love story. If Jane Austen had all the same insights, but she packaged them without two people being in love at the end and having to go through some crap to get there, we wouldn't remember Jane Austen.
Right.
Or only very sophisticated, snotty people would remember Jane Austen. People read for pleasure more than they want to admit. And so something like Cormac McCarthy, he's probably going to last because he's so violent. And there's always going to be a new generation of young men who are like, ooh, Blood Meridian, I heard this is the most violent book ever. I want to give it a shot. And so he'll last in academia for that reason, actually. Like they'll think they're keeping him alive because
he's so sophisticated.
He's so sophisticated and beautiful. Yeah. But the fact is, he writes Westerns and he writes hyper-violent Westerns. And people, there's always going to be a market for that.
And for people who want to feel sophisticated while slaking their bloodlust.
Right, exactly. And I think James Joyce has some obvious sexual stuff. It's like, anybody that you, Madame Bovary, you know, it's a great novel. It also is about a woman. It's not that everything's prurient, but it's just that you can probably, like with Jane Austen, you can always find a hook. Proust is one of those guys who actually is not that way. He does not have a hook, which means that most young men don't find him. Like if this book was just like famously about sex or violence, then we'd find it. And Proust is sexual, but not in a, especially in the later books, you know, it's about love affairs and stuff, but not in a hooky way, not in a way where you're like, ooh, I need to read that. More in like a, how interesting, the morals and mores of Parisian society and whatever. Mm-hmm. Which, so if you're 40 and you're like interested in questions of memory and identity and stuff, you might read this book, like if you're us. If you're in school, if you're in higher academia and they make you read this book, you might read this book. But there's just no reason why your average person is going to decide to read this book, generally speaking. It just does not have the appeal, the surface appeal that so many other great, even Moby Dick, it's like you got revenge, you got a whale, you got a seafarer. Like there's going to be some people who aren't into high literature that are going to at least give it a try. But In Search of Lost Time, it's like it's got a weird title. What is it even about? It's by a Frenchman. There's no plot that you could just put in a sentence. Like there's no log line to put on your movie poster. They haven't made a lot of movies about it. It's just like, it really is. And so I think I say that. I don't remember why I said that. I guess I said that because none of us have read it. It's like,
there's a reason none of us have read it.
And there's a reason probably most of our listeners, even those who are fairly sophisticated and like to read books and all that sort of thing, people who are well-read, maybe haven't gotten to Proust yet. Maybe they know his name as someone you're kind of supposed to get to. But I bet a lot of our listeners don't even really, they probably know his name, but they don't even, he's not even on like the back half of their list. Like if I finish all this stuff, I'll get to Proust. He's one of those guys who's like just not even a thing for a lot of people. Like you remember that Steve Carell said his name a couple times to prove a point about his character in Little Miss Sunshine. He's a reference point for a sort of sophisticated author that people know, and people know a Proustian moment, and maybe they're vaguely, some people know that, and they're vaguely sort of aware of what that is and that that's kind of cool. But, and maybe he's been a little bit rediscovered by like the internet bros, sort of the, we want to mine great literature for like the 10 insights that we can use to build our company, like those guys, or the, I've seen those videos, like the Jordan Peterson crowd. They might find him for that reason, but that's like them sort of bringing their own hook to it that the book doesn't actually, and I doubt many of those guys actually, if I may be a bit of a snob, I doubt they actually read it. They just watch the YouTube video that's like 10 things you can learn from Marcel Proust, you know. So he's kind of unique in that way. Even James Joyce, it's like everybody's read The Dead and at least knows Ulysses is an unreadable thing. Yeah. Yeah. Like it's a thing that they've at least been
it's
like,
it's just infamous. It's,
I don't want to read that.
Yeah. Everybody knows that Ulysses exists and everyone who's read it and thinks it's great is insufferable and stupid and nobody actually wants to read it.
Right. And if you like books, if you don't like books, then maybe you're not listening to this podcast. You don't know any of these references, but if you're into this basic kind of stuff, you know it. And Proust maybe not like that. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe our listeners are all like, oh yes, Proust, I read him when I was 9. But, you know, that's, we need some new listeners then, probably. Anything else you guys want to say about baggage, French culture, vis-a-vis experience and memory and identity and all that stuff?
No.
I had read this book. I'd read Swan's Way, the first volume before, and really enjoyed it. And I was the one that said we should do it because I enjoyed it and thought you guys would enjoy it too, although it is very dense. This is also the kind of book that will defeat a lot of people just because there's so much of it and the sentences are unforgivingly long and sinuous and sort of full of contractions and additional clauses. And like you have to,
it takes work. It
takes a little work.
It takes some elbow grease and there is no hook to drive you through it.
Right.
You just have to enjoy the experience of it. And so part of the difficulty for me in reading it has been not every time, but many times when I pick it up, I end up getting caught in my daydreams about my own life or childhood. And the other is I rarely want to pick it up. And part of the, it's not that I'm like, oh no, I don't want to read Proust. It's like, no, I want some time and space and emotional energy left to engage Proust. And I just don't have that right now. So I don't want to
bother.
I would say more than any other book we've read, this is the book that makes me wish I had that remote from that Adam Sandler movie and I could just hit pause on time itself.
On life, yeah.
And just indulge myself. Like, I wish I was still lived a life where I could just read a book and really, because it requires time and effort and it will reward that time and effort, but it, fitting it in 20-minute bursts as you do other things, it's just not that kind of a book and not every book has to be, but
yeah,
this book is uniquely ill-suited to that. That said, I've now read 2 volumes and I intend to attempt to finish before I die. Hopefully I live a long time. There's 7 of them.
Whoa.
They get a little shorter after volume 4, the ones that were published after his death, which he wrote this all to a pretty, he polished it up a lot. He just didn't polish up the final ones quite as much. But I think it's all good. I think it's all wonderful. And I think our listeners deserve some context. I think for the real neophyte, can we just say what this is? Like, maybe there's somebody who just likes to hear about Barbara Streisand's Mall and listen to our podcast, but they're only vaguely familiar with what In Search of Lost Time is even, like, how would you sum up this?
Well, I mean, that's part of the difficulty, right? You've already said this. So
there's no hook.
There's no hook. There's no log line. There's no nothing. The two comparison points I want to make are really bad because they don't tell you the truth. But I want to pull in Tolstoy and Milhauser. Both, when we talk about Tolstoy or Milhauser, what we talk about is the knack or the ability to try to capture, Tolstoy sort of achieves the closest thing that anybody in literature has ever come close to with just sort of like encapsulating the world
right
as it is, as God built it. And Milhauser doesn't try to do that. He just likes to write about people who do that and go nuts, go crazy, trying to like recreate the fullness of the world within their own little creative world.
Mm-hmm.
And in some sense, Proust is doing something like that, but with himself, with his life, with his childhood, with his life experiences. It's not autobiography, but it's autobiographical. It's just this sense of like, if there is a stone of your life, of the little emotions you felt as a child, that he can turn over and stop and savor them and remind you that was a thing. Those feelings were real. And for a moment, as small looking back as they were, for a moment, they were your whole world and they were all that you had. And the whole universe was bound up in that feeling you had about just needing a kiss from mom or whatever the thing is. Like, he's going to interrogate and try to encapsulate absolutely every aspect of that experience, the experience of life and growing up that he possibly can. He is a Milhauser character.
Right.
And he is approaching Tolstoy in his ability to actually achieve that. And that's what's so beautiful and compelling and interesting. But it's not like, how do you sum that up? I don't know. He's just like, there's these episodes and these memories and...
Yeah, and you can abstract a story from it. You can abstract a basic narrative, but he's not going to give you a chronological sequence
right.
of events.
Very much the opposite.
And so it's like you're being invited to kind of live inside a guy's memories. And really, this first book of Cambrai all takes place like one evening, if you want to follow it from the standpoint of the present.
But it's not even, in a very postmodern way, it's not even the evening of the young boy lying in bed waiting for a kiss from his mother. It's
an
old man.
That's right. A middle-aged guy, right?
Thinking about it.
Or I don't know how old he is, actually.
Yeah, I think he's the age that Proust was when he wrote
right.
it. So yeah. 40s or
sure.
something.
Yeah.
And you get a little sense that he's old, that he's decadent, that he's had lovers and stuff like that. But he's calling forth this childhood memory. And then he's going to eventually remember how, as a child, he remembered
yeah.
stuff from an even earlier age of his childhood. And so it's very... wrapping it, the snake eating its tail sort of thing. For all that, it is very followable in the moment if you're willing to do the work. It is not James Joyce. Like you do always know where you're at when you're reading it, as long as you have the time and the space to to read it. And I don't think the sentences are super defeating. It's just kind of like reading Jane Austen or something. You kind of just have to get in the rhythm of how this person talks, and then it's no problem.
Yeah, and it can take, for me, it takes me a page or two.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a rev time with him, and I'll often go back a couple paragraphs just to find it again.
Right.
And often that's like, well, I'll go a week without reading him.
I bounce back and forth between audiobook and the real book. I really enjoy reading the real book, especially because the translation we have is better than the old translation that the audiobook uses. But the audiobook narrator does give you the advantage of he knows his way through the sentences. So he can really give you some like, oh, that's what I know. I'm supposed to pay attention to that because he said so with his voice.
Yeah.
Which is nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, basically the story is the story of a young man's life and his coming of age. By the time you've read the seven novels, what apparently happens, I've only read two and change of them, but by the end of the last novel, he's decided to write In Search of a Lost Time, and he's gotten to the place where he's gained enough maturity and enough understanding of himself that he can now begin to interrogate himself and write the book that—
You've been reading,
which again sounds awfully self-satisfied, and too clever by half. But I don't know. Just give it a try, and you'll see that it's not that. Whatever else it is, he's very earnest in trying to do this. You can accuse him of being godless, but you can't accuse him of not being sincere in whatever he was trying to do.
He's no hack.
No, he's no hack, and he is a genius. He does have a Tolstoy level eye for detail and memory for detail and ability to see everything, both panoramically and through the eyes of the character that is himself.
It's also a book where he's going to speculate on the nature of consciousness and memory and perception. Just go on all these little vignettes like what makes me me and what makes my memories live and how do I know other people or the world.
Right. It is a philosophical treatise in some way.
In that sense, it dabbles pretty regularly in just existentialist type thought.
Right.
Of more of the French school, I think.
Oh, very much. And he was very influential on all those guys.
Yeah. And so you're going to think about, you should read Ecclesiastes before you read it and get some handles, or otherwise you're going to get, if you don't have strong handles, you can get swept to sea in the thought of meaning and memory and legacy and existence and purpose and
who death. Am I? And I'm remembering all this stuff, and it's all going to just
it's gonna
be
disappear.
Gone when I die.
It's going to be buried.
Right.
I'm going to be nothing. All these memories are going to go away, and I'm going to be a name on a tombstone. And it's just gone. It's all gone. And even if I write it down, and it's considered a classic, and it's read for 100 years or 200 years after I'm gone, well, for how long?
Right.
For how long? Until even that gets forgotten.
Which, this is reminding me of a movie we didn't review for Sanity at the Movies and that we didn't see, but you saw, Nathan, The Boy and the Heron.
Yeah, this is true. Yes, The Boy and the Heron. Did I talk about that on a podcast or not? I don't remember.
Did you? Maybe not.
Maybe briefly.
I don't know. I'll go over to Sanity at the Movies. You can find out whether we recorded an episode on The Boy and the Heron. The Boy and the Heron is Miyazaki as an 80-year-old or whatever he is making a movie about how all of his other movies are useless and there is no one that can take over his legacy. And if there was, what would it matter? And it feels very pointed in its despair in a way that actually Proust doesn't. Proust at least worships art, which is not a good thing. But he is like, by writing this book, I'm leaving something. I'm doing something. I'm transforming some of the materials of my life into something that is useful or good. And you kind of have to give it to him because he kind of did. And like you said, Jake, he's dead. He's probably in hell, not to be too mean about it, but
we've got his book and we're talking about it still.
Yeah. I mean, he did. The idea that this author went through all this so that he could write all this that he went through does have a kind of existential beauty to it. I say that somewhat begrudgingly, but it's true. There's a reason we all feel those things. There's a reason King Solomon wrote about those things. So let's give a little context, though, because I hear some guns going off for some reason that really no longer applies because everything changes and people disappear and life is sad. But Ben...
But those gunshots, they bring you back to a time.
Right. I can smell the gunpowder. My dad used to shoot at my mom. regularly. No, that never happened. That never happened. Ben, you have a little bit of context on La Belle Époque. La Belle Époque, however you say it. I don't know how to say any of these things.
La Belle Époque. That's what I'll say too. La Belle Époque.
This is the era that Proust was part of.
The beautiful era, which was not so named during the beautiful era. It was named after the beautiful era when France and Europe looked back and thought, man, that was the beautiful era. That was an awesome time. That was like the best of European civilization. We love it. Let's give it a name. What can we call it? I know. The beautiful era.
The beautiful era.
And then they did, but it is Proust's own lifetime was 1871 to 1922. And you could date the start of this era from about 1871 or 1880 to 1914. So this era is bookended by wars.
1914. I feel like something happened.
Something did happen there.
That has influenced almost every book we've talked about.
Don't worry about it. Forget about it. Forget about it. World War One. And before that, like 1870 is when
I was thinking
the Franco-Prussian War ended, which is a massive deal for France. What were you thinking, Jake?
When was Babe Ruth traded to the Yankees?
In 1914. I knew it.
Not until 1920.
Not until 1920.
There you go, man.
When was Babe Ruth's rookie?
This is part of the Belle Epoque.
1914.
There you go. Beautiful.
There it is.
Yep, there you go.
There you go.
Another 1914.
Knowledge that will die. Well, actually, that
the
knowledge will die.
The debut of the great Bambino.
The great Bambino.
The SWAT, the Colossus of Cloud.
That's like America's Belle Epoque stuff, but this is Europe's
Murderers
time.
Row.
Baseball Murders Epoque. Or
baseball, yes.
Belle, whatever.
Going into the Golden 20s, buddy.
Yes, indeed. Well, anyway, this was a time when lots of stuff was happening. In France especially, you could think of France as like the exemplar of the Belle Epoque, although Europe would claim it more broadly. But you've got an interesting time because of the Franco-Prussian War, which Germany came in and they totaled the French Empire at the time, the Second Empire, and
I like to do that.
They took some land away, and And so France was ticked, and it was recovering, but it was coming into a new and different time. It was now a republic. So you had all these ideals going on. You had democratic republic ideal. And you'd also just gotten through not only that war, but you had this incident where this group called the Paris Commune seized power just in Paris for 2 months. This is a radical socialist anarchist kind of a movement, this anti-religious feminist movement that was bloodily suppressed by the French. And it took place during the lifetime of Marx and Engels, and they were like, yeah, that was awesome. Engels was like, that was a true example of the dictatorship of the proletariat. Those French, they'd like to give Marx and Engels credit for their mill. And then there was this guy named General Georges Boulanger, or General General Revenge, as he was called, because his deal was...
What an awesome name. He sounds like a Transformer or something.
Yeah, or General Revenge.
Revenge.
Yeah, because what he wanted, what his platform was, and he came close to seizing power, although he failed, was, dude, I hate the Germans. You hate the Germans. We all hate them together. Let's take back some French lands. Dude, let's get them. Anyway, he died. He wasn't successful. And then you have, you just have all this interesting sort of political foment in and around the Belle Epoque. And then within the Belle Epoque proper, when you get to 1889, you have of the very famous Exposition Universelle, the Paris World's Fair, which was celebrating the 100th anniversary of the French Revolution, specifically the storming of the Bastille. The Bastille. I can't pronounce French words either, which was a massive success. The Eiffel Tower, it was constructed for this fair. This fair drew like 32 million visitors. It was the last sort of French World's Fair thing to actually make money. People came from all over. Countries with monarchies boycotted the event. They were like, this is not cool. We're not celebrating this with you. Like, forget you guys. But of course, plenty of their citizens came and paid their money and saw all kinds of crazy stuff. So,
and by the way, can I just throw in there?
Yeah.
The Ferris wheel was our answer to the Eiffel Tower. Mm-hmm. That is the Americans saying, the French.
We win.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, they're like, we've got the they've got their belly packed. They're coming up with all this cool technology and stuff. We're going to come up with a big thing that turns.
Yeah, and of course, famously, the inventor of the Eiffel Tower, also the builder, also built an American thing.
The Liberty de
Statue. The Statue of Liberty. Yep. That's right. So there's a little connection. Anyway, I don't know, just to give you kind of an idea of what's going on. I mean, it's this is going on, a lot of this stuff in America too, but consider it especially, and I guess you could say, well, America had our Civil War. We're getting over that. But in Europe, it's different. All these powers were just clashing. And now France is a democratic republic, and the Second Industrial Revolution is going on. And there's like gas power and electricity and plumbing, and machines are making cheaper clothing, and there's more leisure time for especially the upper and middle classes, although there's plenty of awful poverty around too to go around. There's cars and there's scooters and there's better bicycles, and France is the leader in aviation. It has the first national air force that it establishes in 1910, which is about in time for World War I. It's got the telephone. You've got the germ theory of disease. You've got pasteurization courtesy of Louis Pasteur, who's French. You've got Marie Curie, who's French or part French or something. And you've got all of this scientific and artistic stuff going on in France. You've got the very tail end of the Impressionist era of painting. But what you've got in the Belle Epoque really is the pendulum swing, the post-Impressionists, who are like, we'll see you and we'll up the ante. Like, that's not good enough. So guys like, oh, Paul Cézanne, you know, and painters like that. So you've got tons of stuff happening. And then you've got entertainment springing up to match the new freed up wealth and leisure time of the middle classes. You've got public theaters and music halls, the famous Moulin Rouge showplace, which is still around. You've got restaurants coming into their own. It's like, there's restaurants now. There's gourmet cuisine. And all the European powers at the same time as all this extra wealth and all these extra ideas are around are busy colonizing. Like, they are still imperial powers. Land holdings in Africa increase from 10 to 90%. 10 to 90%, from 10% of the continent to about 90%. And you've got the rise of Marxism at the same time. And France is a good place for this stuff because France, since the French Revolution, is just more secularized. You've got the rise of Marxism. You've got women's suffrage making a showing. You've got anarchism as a force. You've got union movements and industrial workers. There's just all of this crazy stuff happening. And so when you think of it in terms of wars of ideas or whether or not God is being honored, what you really have, you know, I think, as I, in my reading about this stuff, it's like, yeah, this is a nice time to live in terms of creature comforts and a lot of things, but it's also a pretty godless time. And there's a lot of ideologies ready to erupt and become really ugly. And of course, politically speaking, globally speaking, all of these tensions that are setting the stage, unbeknownst to most everyone, for World War I, which is going to wreck. It's going to be the end of the Belle Epoque. Oh yeah, you've also got, this is also the time of the Dreyfus Affair, the famous Dreyfus Affair, which was a case that in France that lasted from 1894 to 1906, which that's a significant chunk of the Belle Epoque. The Dreyfus Affair is this scandal. It's this army officer of Jewish descent who's accused of treason and sentenced to life in prison, but it's clear he's the wrong guy. And as new evidence comes to light that ought to exonerate him, the case is reopened and the courts are like, nope, because anti-Semitism is a big thing in Europe, definitely in France. And it finally becomes a big enough public scandal that the courts have to exonerate him, restore him to a position in the military. And there's, I don't know, it's just a really, it's just a wild time. So that's the Belle Epoque, and that's like Proust's entire lifetime, almost. Proust lives past World War I. He lives to 1922, but he's born just at the end of the Franco-Prussian War, and he gets to see the end of the Belle Epoque and live in this weird world of decadent, glittering surfaces, where there's like the structures of Catholicism in society, but not the beating heart of Roman Catholicism, we might say, at least not in his life.
No, quite a decadent time. There's not a thing you said there, including the Jewish stuff, that doesn't directly impact this novel and Proust's life. Most of the books, these books were published after 1914. So In Search of Lost Time is, in mm-hmm. some sense, a man looking back in a very Proustian way on mm-hmm. a world that has passed away. I mean, it's a little bit like, if you want to compare it to the antebellum South, you had this flourishing of culture in the South, and then it just got wiped out by the Civil War. And there, obviously, it's not a popular thing these yeah. days, but there were generations of people who looked back very nostalgically and fondly on the sort of aristocratic culture that they had in the South. It's a little, you could compare it to the Downton Abbey kind of, mm-hmm. Which is technically, I guess, in the Belle Epoque, in the very beginning. That era, you know, if you've read Edith mm-hmm. Wharton, Age of Innocence, or it's this kind of flowering of culture where you have all these fruity aristocrats that get to really enjoy themselves in a developing middle class, and then it doesn't go very well.
Well, here, I have to read you this quote I found on a blog that's very insightful about the Belle Epoque. A period of prosperity and charm. The Belle Epoque was the true foundation for modern life, providing us with crucial stepping stones toward modern life as we know it today. End quote. Isn't that?
That's very helpful.
That's very helpful.
Did ChatGPT write that blog?
Probably so. I don't know. I don't know what these people's problem is.
It is the birthplace of a lot of things that have continued to haunt our century and the 20th century into the 21st century. The rise of the suffragette movement, race relations, Marxism, all that stuff. So, and the French have just for hundreds of years now been on the forefront of godlessness. Uh-huh. There is no real sense of God outside of sort of an artistic force that keeps nice cathedrals mm-hmm. up and running.
The literal cutting edge, we might say.
Yes. Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, mm-hmm. they had their decadent little revolution, and things have just never been the same since. I don't know. Marcel Proust, I will tell you about him. He was born to Adrian Proust, who was a very respected doctor from a provincial French Catholic background, and to Jean, a woman from a prosperous Jewish family. So he is half Jewish, which doesn't probably play in this section very much, but is important because the character of Marcel is not really played as Jewish, but he has Jewish friends. The idea of Jewishness and anti-Semitism and the Dreyfus Affair, all very important in the novel. And it's interesting to speculate about Proust's self-hatred maybe as a Jew. It's mm-hmm. interesting to speculate about his sense of introspection as a Jew. We've talked about these kinds of things on various podcasts, maybe more for our movie podcasts than anything else. But his Jewish identity, his love-hate affair with his own Jewish identity is something that you can trace through this novel. As you can probably imagine, he's an asthmatic child, weakling, kind of your classic artistic case, has a big attack of asthma in 1880. But his family is prosperous, and he gets to experience the best of La Belle Epoque. He gets to go to all these coastal retreats, and like the place that Cambrai is based on, you can – some of these places, like Illiers, I don't know if that's how you pronounce it. I really don't know how to pronounce French, but they've actually changed their name to Cambrai. Like a number of these places have actually – changed their name to match Proust because he's the one that made, you know, it's kind of like Transylvania. It's like, newsflash, Dracula the vampire did not actually live in Transylvania. He's a fictional creation, but the Transylvanian tourism industry wants to play up Dracula as much as they can. And so they're just like, yeah, hey, there's Dracula's castle. I'm like, well, no, it's not Dracula's castle. It's Bob the Carpathian's castle. But we can make more money by calling it Dracula's castle.
It was Vigo.
Vigo. Yes, I'm sorry. Vigo the Carpathian. Vigo the Transylvanian. So there's a whole, like, Proust is one of those guys, like Jane Austen. She's one of those guys who inspire, you know, people want to go to Bath. They want to go to the place. They want to experience. They want to walk through Aunt Whatever's household. They want to see the place where he first kissed Gilbert and stuff like that. So there's a whole tourism industry built around this guy. He did military service from 1889 to 90. Studies at the School of Political Sciences, earning licenses in law and literature. Proust was a licensed literature guy, but he never needed to make money. He's basically an aristocrat in the last era where they really existed in this way. But he sort of, as a young man, becomes a fixture in these aristocratic circles, kind of the thing that we picture from Jane Austen or from Tolstoy. You know, you go to these salons and you've got a woman holding court and everybody gathers around her. And you have witty banter with each other, and somebody maybe plays the piano, and the beautiful young ingenues are there, and that sort of thing. He wants to be a writer. He's decided early on that he's destined to be a writer, but he's lazy. He's dissipated. He's bad at it. He's more interested in just living his life and enjoying the pleasures of his day. But he begins to write this thing called Jean Santeel from 1895 to 1899, which has a lot of the raw materials that the Remembrance of, sorry, we should have said, this thing goes by two English titles. A lot of people know it as Remembrance of Lost Time, Remembrance of Things Past, mm-hmm. which is cribbed from Shakespeare and not a literal translation of the novel's title, but it's what the translator back in the day decided on, and the novel's basically been stuck with that for many decades until somebody decided, actually, it's much more pretty if we do the literal translation of the French, which is In Search of Lost Time, and I would have to agree that is a superior mm-hmm. title. But some of our listeners may know this under Remembrance of Things Past. So basically, he is very actively involved in the Dreyfus affair as like a pundit, and it makes him some enemies. His health begins to decline, and involved in the Dreyfus affair defending Dreyfus.
I figured.
Yeah. He gets a lot of social backlash for that, kind of gets ostracized from some of the best of these elite salons that he was part of. He's also just a sickly dude and has, if I say it's a weird relationship with his mom, you're going to think sexual, Oedipal kind of thing. That's not really what it is, but just kind of a sickly gay young man relationship with his mom where she does everything for him. I don't think he ever actually moved out of his parents' house for his entire life. They just died and he continued to live there, but he has various women in his life and things like that. But he encounters this critic named John Ruskin's work in 1898, which makes him think that everything that he'd written for the last 5 years, and this is John's Chastel, was just crap. And he's like, oh, I need to do something totally different. I need to like not have a plot, and I need to capture the universe. I need to take what I love about nature and what I love about Gothic architecture and somehow find a literary equivalent. And he said, reading Ruskin, the universe regained an immense worth in my eyes. So he suddenly begins to see things through Proustian eyes, which he ought to be able to do as well as anybody because he's Proust. And so he's like, all right, I've got to write my thing. But he's still living a dissipated life. His parents are still alive. His dad dies in 1903, and then his mom dies in 1905, and he's just devastated and takes a long time to recover from that. But now he's got all the money in the world. He can do whatever he wants with it. World War I hasn't hit yet, so he's just an aristocrat that can basically do whatever he wants. And so in 1905, he decides he's finally going to do it. He's finally going to knuckle down. He's going to write his masterpiece. And in order to do that, he needs to establish the philosophical underpinnings of his masterpiece. So he writes a very famous essay called Contre Saint-Beuve. I'm sure I don't know how to pronounce that. Challenging the French notion of literature as an activity for the civilized mind and advocating his own belief in art's ability to unveil the hidden truth of unconscious memory. So he's like, not only am I going to do this, but actually everybody should be doing this. And the fact that nobody is doing this is why we're stupid. So I guess he actually, in 1909, he has an incident like I had with Victoria's Secret, like Jake's had, like Ben has never had, where he eats a cookie. And a bunch of memories come flooding back, and that is the key. Now he has, like, this is where my novel starts. And so by May of that year, he has commenced writing In Search of Lost Time. It is initially rejected, the first volume, by the most prominent publishers of its day, and he has to publish Swan's Way at his own expense. But it actually enjoys modest success. Like, this did not take long. This is not one of those things where people didn't get it. They got it. They saw that this guy was a genius. And actually, there's this very funny, I didn't bother to copy it over, so I don't have the exact wording of it, but his author, the publisher that turned him down, wrote him a letter and said, hey, I'm sorry, we should have published your stuff. And Proust wrote him back, and he did accept it. He didn't just like give him the middle finger, but he kind of did it in a very clever French middle fingery kind of way. Like, I want to thank you for rejecting my work. It really motivated me to double down, and he just at great elaborate length goes through and thanks this guy for kicking him in the teeth in a way that Reese is pretty sarcastic, again, in that very refined kind of way. Proust, as you can imagine, he keeps going back. He keeps working on the novel, building out the structure, infusing more elements into it, rewriting, snake eating its tail. And in 1916, as World War I goes, we released the second volume, which we Americans mostly know as Within a Budding Grove. It's actually something like In the Shadow of Young Girls in Flower, which you can see why they didn't want to use that. After the war, he publishes two more volumes. And basically, the legend of Proust, whether it's technically true or not, is that he is in bed, really doesn't leave his apartment for the last years of his life. He's just got to get this novel out of his system. And he does not do it. He dies in... when did he actually die? 1920. Man, you'd think I would have written that down. Marcel Proust died in, 1922, with the last three volumes of In Search of Lost Time in an advanced state of revision, but not as done as he probably would have liked. So they're fine. They've been released. It's not one of those things where it was just his notes or something like that. Like, we had it. We had a decent version of it, but there are things that don't quite line up about the plot, things that he probably would have revised, things that it seems clear like he would have done this or that had he lived. But the last three volumes are published posthumously. And by 1927, we have all seven volumes of In Search of Lost Time. Proust is fairly clearly documented to have been a homosexual, although you always have to take these kinds of things with a grain of salt, just because modern scholars so want him to be a homosexual, they will take any scrap of evidence and say, well, there, you see, he must have been a homosexual. But he never actually admitted to it, which is interesting. But like his housekeeper famously denied it in her memoirs. But many of his friends and his contemporaries and his valet and fellow writers said, oh, yeah, he was a homosexual. And most people assume that the various love affairs that are documented with women in the book are actually him protecting his own sort of – protecting himself by changing them into young ladies. Hmm. Most of his friends say that he visited male prostitutes, that he was a pretty decadent and bad guy. It is interesting that he even fought a duel, actually, to say that he didn't. So it's interesting. You can go and do your own research if you want. This is certainly one of the first novels to openly talk about homosexuality. It will, even in not the volume we're discussing today, but
it does.
Or does it?
Yeah, it has. It has that guy's daughter.
The
guy who dies. I don't remember his name.
Yes. Yeah. He is one of the first major popular novelists to just be like, yeah, there's lots of people out there that are homosexual, and that's the thing. And to sort of contemplate it in his philosophical Proustian way. And there's lots of it. There's an entire volume of this book called Sodom and Gomorrah, which is an interesting title, and it would have been Proust's title. And it is about all the homosexual activity that was happening in Paris, which was apparently very much a thing that everybody knew about. And I don't know if whether it was technically against the law or not, probably was, but
still the cutting edge of decadence and anti-Christianity.
They were the cutting edge of decadence. A lot of people saw something very beautiful in lesbianism. That's always been the cutting edge of what you're going to show to people if you want them to be attracted to this particular vice. And Proust is no different. He depicts a lot of that sort of thing. There's all kinds of reasons why a weak or morally compromised person shouldn't read this book. I would say that might not actually be in the top one or two, just simply because he's not pornographic. He's not actually describing, for the most part, sexuality in a way that is enticing. He's just very much talking about it as a thing, which can be its own enticement. I'm not trying to defend it. I'm just saying, if you're curious as to why we would even touch a book with this kind of content, it's because it's not exactly the worst of what it could be. But that certainly is who Proust was. I don't think there's anything else we really need to say. He lived a fairly uneventful, decadent life and then finally pulled it together in time to get four volumes and most of the revisions done on three more volumes of a masterpiece, and then he died. The big legend, like I said, is that he was just cooped up in his apartment for the last years of his life, just sacrificing himself to get this masterpiece out. So if people know anything about Proust's life, they know he ate a cookie and had some memories, and they know that he, as he neared death, was desperately trying to finish this masterpiece, which fortunately he finished well enough, even though I'm sure he would have liked more time He was always in search of it.
He was.
But that is Proust. Obviously, this novel has had a huge impact on French existentialism, among other things. Your Sartre and Camus and stuff like that, they all would have been familiar with this, all the sort of decadent French filmmaking of the 60s. Like, this is in the direct line with all that stuff. It's in a direct line with postmodern novels we've read, like, what's the Indian one, Jake? Rushdie.
Midnight Children.
Midnight Children. That's magical realism. It's his own thing, but it's his own thing that doesn't exist without Proust saying, hey, we can do weird things with narrative. We can be entirely sort of self-referential, and a lot of bad, dumb people, not that Salman Rushdie's necessarily one of them, but a lot of bad, dumb people have taken the basic, hey, I can be a narcissist and I can be masturbatory, and Proust gave
produce something that people will call great.
Yeah. A lot of it, which we would say is hot garbage, but for better or worse, Proust opened the door to that kind of thing. There's your context. We've already done baggage. I hear the snap of the cameras, the sound of the camera shutter, bringing us into the part of the show where we talk the big picture. I think maybe we already did talk big picture.
It's hard to talk anything else, really.
Yeah, I mean, what else do you guys want to say about...
There's any number of, like, sort of golden passages. The part with the tea and the Madeline is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that he describes things is often beautiful and memorable. I guess we're going to go to style a little
later. Yeah, we'll get to
Solana style. Okay, so I won't talk about that. But there are just a couple of things that were helpful, like, that you weren't expecting. Like, one section where he talks about, hey, have you ever become aware of how we have all these feelings, but then instead of actually dealing with them or looking at them, we just, like, suppress them and they come out in stupid ways, and we never know ourselves any better? I remember when I learned that lesson.
Right.
I was walking along this trail, the Guermantes way. And so, but of course, he's not going to be goofy about it like I am. He's just going to be, yeah, this is what we do. And you're like, oh, yeah, this is what we do. We don't gain anything by it. We just our feelings.
I said this in our preview episode. I really think it's true. And I really think maybe some people would think this is an offensive comparison point, but I think it's a good one. This book really reminds me of Augustine's Confessions. Obviously, Augustine, very godly man, Proust, very not. But Augustine just has this basic idea that, like, the mystery of who I am in relation to the universe that I happen to find myself in is, like, infinitely deep and interesting. So the fact that I stole those pears that one time or whatever it is.
It's pears.
That really matters to the entire history of my soul before, as I confess everything to God. Like, the pears, big deal. Said everything about who I am and who I should have been and about where I stood.
That's when I learned that I was evil.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
I stopped to think about it and I was like, well, why did I take the stupid pears?
Right.
Well, why? I had better pears. I didn't even eat them. Like, it was just the thrill of evil.
It is, I was evil. And Augustine has that sort of eye that he puts on everything. It can be, I walked past some roadkill or I saw some flower. Like, it's similar to Proust, not in every way, but just in that sort of everything is grist for the mill of my understanding of myself and my place in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're both helpful in their ways in that you read them and you're like, oh, I was on Twitter yesterday. I was playing Candy Crush. You know, how much I should actually, there's times to have fun and all that, but how much do I actually think about who I am, what I feel, where I stand on this spinning globe going through the cosmos? Like, how much do I actually engage with me? And they just sort of give you glasses to look at the world and realize, like, oh, yeah, there's something of value here. I should understand myself and I should understand God. Now, Proust wouldn't tell you to understand God.
Well, but what's interesting is Proust is always talking about God without, you could say maybe without wanting to. I don't know. I don't actually know what I think about what he wanted or not in that regard. But there is, he's always conscious of God.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to put it. It just is a fact. If anyone's going to spend so much time carefully looking at their life and at the creation and just talking about everything, and then he's going to talk about evil. Like, he's going to talk about this. It's actually that lesbian episode that he describes where he talks about, it was then that I understood sadism. I'm not even going to try to recreate it for you, listener,
but it was really interesting.
It's basically two young women, you know, a woman and her lover, mocking the fact that her dad, who loved her and sacrificed for her, died.
Yep.
They're having this very mean-spirited, callous conversation about it.
Yeah.
And Proust happens to observe it. And it has a little bit of the charge of the observing this forbidden lesbian thing. But actually more so, it's just like, oh, they are cruel. And there's no reason for them to be. This man loved her.
Right. And the fact that the daughter is so cruel in this particular way makes her less evil than if she were cruel in this way.
Yes.
Because she's conscious of transgressing a limit and feels bad about it.
Yeah, he actually
says,
like,
the cruelty of that.
She wants to transgress here, which proves that she still has some kind of conscience or
something
like
that. Yeah. Stuff like that. But it just, anyway, there's something to him. It's like he's always facing God somehow. But I don't know how to put it better than that.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds kind of Gospel Coalition-y when you put it that way, but he is. He's always...
He's not going to talk about him.
No, he doesn't seem to have any real place for acknowledging that God exists. Like, God really is just like, oh, my grandma sort of believed in... It's a very, like, yeah, of course we all believe in God culture, which doesn't make it that different than our culture, I guess. I don't know. Any other big picture thoughts, guys? Because if not... I hear the horns blowing. The Hall of Heroes brings us into the Hall of Heroes, where we name the hero from the book and decide if they measure up.
There are no heroes, Nathan. There are only memories.
This book might defeat our
Yeah.
It's like Hannibal Lecter to Clarice Starling. Do you think you can dissect me with this blunt tool? This book might break our blunt bookening tool here. All right, well, I know it sounded like Jake was about to say something.
No.
Insight?
No, there's no insight. He's the main character of his own story that he's telling, and he's not a hero. He's just the subject matter. So,
I will say one thing that's interesting about you saying that is this is not an unreliable narrator story. I mean, it is like every character is kind of Proust and that we're just living inside his head and his memories, but he's not playing games with... Can we trust Marcel here? Are we as the reader supposed to understand a meta-narrative that the character doesn't understand? There's none of that.
Yeah.
Which that's like all the postmodern stuff that came in the wake of this, which just like is so tiresome. But he does not do that, which is, I think, maybe one of the ways that he is not tiresome.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what I never tire of, though, is a great villain. And now we're going into the villain's lair. Where we declare who the true villain of the piece is.
Well, you see, Marcel, he's sort of the main character, and he exists. And
very profound.
Yes. Hey, death.
Everyone is evil.
Yeah, everyone.
That's one thing you find. It's like, oh, Francois, yeah, she was this cool servant that my aunt had, and we liked her, and she liked us. And you read like 50 pages more, you're like, Francois was really evil. Like, here's all the things that she did. Here's the way that she really was. You're like, oh, here's more about my aunt. She was really evil. It's just like, yeah, these people are terrible.
But none of them are villains. They're just self-motivated people being people.
That's right.
Yeah, Tolstoy would do.
It's not villainy, but it's just, it is pretty dark.
It's just like, it does have kind of that Tolstoy feeling of, I'm not out to get anybody, but I am just...
Yeah.
I cannot help, like, the apparatus of my mind and my observation undresses everyone and shows you everything. And it turns out most people suck. So I'm not trying to be cynical. I'm not trying to make a point of it, but I'm just like telling you how it was. And it turns out it was terrible. You got a quote for us, Ben?
I know what I was, the one that I found most unbelievable is that friend of his dad's, Le Grandin.
Oh, yeah.
And the dad was trying to get him to say, do you have friends in this one area where Marcel's going to go for vacation? And the guy didn't want to expose his connections because he was class conscious or something. But he just the way that he would not answer, I have friends wherever there are companies of trees, wounded but not vanquished, which huddle together with touching obstinacy to implore an inclement and pitiless sky. And just think of the decadence of this time and just the insanity of that guy existing. And I believe in him.
Words.
I believe in him. He was created, I believe that was a real guy who would talk that way, but it just, it is insane.
Yeah.
It is crazy.
Yeah.
I don't know what to say. You just feel like these people were characters.
Right.
And the only thing, well, I've known some characters in my life, but, and I've known some people who have a little bit of the flavor of LeGrandin, but I haven't known LeGrandin.
Right. Yeah, it's like a cultural thing. It's like in American modern culture, we are supposed to be authentic. It's not that we actually are. It's not that we don't lie to ourselves and other people all the time. But the idea behind a conversation is that we're not being performative. We're just sort of talking.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not the idea behind conversations that these people are trained up and brought up to engage in. Like, there's an art to it. There's a performative aspect to it that's, you might remind some people of Jane Austen, might remind some people of the upper echelons of power in Tolstoy.
But Jane Austen's time is less decadent.
Right.
The conversations exist to foster actual intimacy or tell you what you need to know. But LeGrandin just exists. And Swan.
Right.
They're like the art for art's sake version of men talking.
Yes. I mean, you also, with Jane Austen, you're like, did everybody talk this way? Or is this how Jane Austen liked to write witty dialogue? Like, I don't know that it's one-to-one representative of what life was like. But I feel like the stuff that Proust is describing is so wild. There's no way that you get you wouldn't invent that. It actually feels
like
there had to have been that guy, or at least a very specific analog for that guy.
Yeah.
Just everything about Francois, everything about his mom coming to give him a kiss, a goodnight kiss. It's just, it's very well observed. I'm struggling for something more profound than that, but it's like this guy knew people pretty well.
Yeah.
All right. Here comes the speeding roadster. Oh, no, that was the crawlway of secondary characters.
I guess I stepped on that.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Is there anything else you want to say about secondary characters? I'm not even going to put us through the crawlway sound effect here.
All of these people are interesting. Again, just keep repeating it. What an alien world, if it is to read about them.
Well, we said this on the other podcast. We didn't say it on this one. You and I both made the same comment, which is that this reminded us of science fiction. It reminds us of our favorite science fiction author, Gene Wolfe.
Yeah.
Who's just like, hey, I'm going to build out an incredible alien world full of people who don't have the same exact moral boundaries or system that you do.
And who are strange to you and whose motivations you don't entirely comprehend. I'm going to give you incomplete information about them. You're really going to feel like there is a world out there that you don't understand.
Yeah.
It's like in a more typical novel, some of these secondary characters, they wouldn't not get under your skin. I don't have a better phrase, but they wouldn't stick with you the same way.
Right. Well, I think that does speak to some of the novel. I think some of the appeal that this novel and these seven novels have, or seven volumes, is actually similar to science fiction or fantasy in the thorough escapism that it provides. Not traditional escapism like reading about high adventure or something, but the I am going to step into a completely other world. There are a lot of people, just like with Jane Austen, she wasn't writing to necessarily because she was so in love with her time and place, but there are a lot of people that like to just luxuriate in their idea of that era of Regency England. And I think in the same way, people love the idea of riding a bicycle down the Garamantes Way and the little French girls and the decadent aristocrat French dudes and the salons and the... It all has a certain romance, I guess. Not for me, really. But I do find that this book is compelling in a way that does remind me a little bit even of something like Tolkien, where I'm just like, oh, that's weird. I just hung out in an alien world and got kind of absorbed in it. I love plot. I think plot should always be very high on the list of things that you figure out. I don't think you should be one of those artists who just disdains plot if you're a writer. But plot can be, you do read something like this and you're like, okay, well, plot's not everything. It's nice sometimes to watch a movie or read a book or engage with something where it's about just living.
It's not plot driven in the moment. Anyway. Yeah.
But it's best when you're Jane Austen and you can just hecka do both. Hey, what's that? Speaking of salons, we're entering the Salon of Style, where we will while away the hours discussing the power.
Flowers. The powers of flowers.
Yeah. Ben, you had some style thoughts or something?
Maybe I did. I'm trying to remember now. We already said they're long sentences. Oh, yeah, that's right. My thought was, in a long sentence, what he'll do is instead of leaving you with one metaphor or analogy,
mm-hmm.
he'll like pile three or four on top of each other, and not just like three or four for the same thing, but he'll like step from one analogy to the next one,
mm-hmm.
like a platform hanging in the air. And so he's like, just until you're at three or four removes from the original physical object or person or thing that he's remembering. He does that a lot. And it's pretty impressive, actually. That's maybe the hardest thing to follow in certain passages.
Yeah, why don't I hate it? I feel like I should hate that.
Because it's legit. Because it's tight, like what he's doing.
Usually when we're commenting on that, it's because some dumb sci-fi author tried to do that, like the Ray Bradbury.
Clumsy. He's not clumsy. It's very tight. It's like all the images are still connected, but he just goes, here's four, here's five, in like a giant paragraph of a sentence or something.
Yeah, it reminds me of like John Donne or William Shakespeare, I dare say,
yeah.
or one of those guys.
Yeah.
It's just like, I think a talk entirely in metaphor. And so if I'm describing a bush, then the bush is looking at us, and it's also a tower, and also it's...
And that reminds me, and it also then becomes a metaphor for the way that memory works.
Right.
And speaking of memory, how about that bush? It's that kind of thing.
Right.
Except not dumb.
I do think art does... We always say, give them two and two, and let the audience make four. They'll love you forever. Like a movie doesn't need to explain everything. In fact, it shouldn't, because it's more pleasurable sometimes for you to put things together.
Have things to think about.
Yeah, have things to think about. I think in that sense, people need to not be lazy. And we've said, we all had difficulty getting through this book. We're not going to do all seven volumes. We couldn't do that. But people need to not forget that there is pleasure to be derived from doing mental work just for fun. The reason I say that is because sometimes you read one of these sentences and you have to make five leaps with them, and then you get to the end, and then because he's a genius, it does all actually snap together all in a moment, and you get that little almost dopamine rush. You get that little feeling like when you've finally understood a math equation or something like that of, oh, I get it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fun. That's enjoyable.
Yeah.
That's actually why people enjoy poetry a lot of the times.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that there's not much of a market for that kind of enjoyment these days.
Yeah.
Or if it is, it's only for the very decadent on their HBO shows or something like that. But, and even those are like a dumb person's idea of what smart should be. Like, it's not that we're snobs who just like difficult things. It's that I think
there are a lot more complicated processes in pleasure than simple dopamine hits.
Yes.
And the reality is we live in a world where we're just sort of dopamine saturated. Where it is just easy hit after easy hit after easy hit after easy hit. And part of what that does is it takes away your ability to delay gratification, to work for things, and the desire to do that sort of thing. And it just makes everything harder. And there are richer pleasures and deeper pleasures and more lasting pleasures that come with effort. And we would just do well to put our phones away for a weekend and take a couple of days and try to reset every once in a while. It's not that those things are bad. It's just that, man, there's this whole world of life and experience out there that we miss when we live in front of our screens and they're getting hit with trigger on trigger on trigger on trigger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's deeper pleasure to be found in putting in the effort and in the final payoff when you put in the effort. I mean, it's my theory for why a certain kind of person loves Costco and Sam's Club. Because I think they intentionally design those stores to be obnoxious. Like you can only go in this door, you can only go out that door. There's going to be the person that checks your thing, because that actually, once by the time you're done putting in the work, you feel like I got some really good, in a way that you wouldn't. Now for me, I don't like that sort of thing, and I don't like to go to those stores, and I just think that they're super annoying. But I've watched other people who just like they have almost a romantic relationship with Sam's Club. They love it, and I think it's actually because it looks ugly. It feels dumb and everything is cumbersome.
But you feel like you came away with some treasure.
Right. And if it was easy, if you could walk in there and the thing that you wanted was right there, and then the checkout girl was right there. Checkout girl, what am I? I'm a sexist old guy, I guess. And then you could just walk out. It actually wouldn't feel nearly as good. It's they're actually doing their customer base a service. It's not just about we got to put the really good products in the back or something because we're evil capitalists. It's like, no, we want them to feel the maximum pleasure from Sam's Club, and so make it a little difficult. And I think great art can be like that, or even just fun art, even just make people work a little bit for it, and the pleasure will be greater. It's certainly true of romance. You could be a jerk and look at pornography like a sinful person, or you can have a romantic relationship with your wife or your husband, and that romantic relationship does not begin at the bed in the bedroom at 10 p.m. It begins that morning. I mean, this is just how God designed. He just made us to work. I think that's my deep, profound thought about it. I think you go back to Genesis 1 and 2, and you see we were made to work. We derive pleasure from work, and even our greatest pleasures have an awful lot of work in them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we should not. And so, you know, booketing podcast, very anti-snob, very anti-James Joyce's Ulysses. That's not what I'm talking about. But I do want to make some apologia for the fact that Proust has long sentences that you have to take your time with. It's not going to be everyone's cup of tea. Not everyone's going to have time for it. Some people are going to have work that's more important that makes it so they can't live lives of just engaging with Proust. Fine with me. But if you're going to engage with him, then you shouldn't resent the treasure that he's buried for you and the way that he's buried it, because it actually does make the treasure better. Anything else to say about style? Mm-mm. All right. I think we've probably already basically said what we want to say, but we do need to enter the haven of reflection upon deeper. Any other thoughts on the deeper meaning of a book like this? Why would we be attracted to it? That sort of thing.
Just like it's all big picture, it's all reflection on deeper meaning. And what's nice about Proust is, hey, here's a discipline that's going to, there's so many, it's like going to the gym. You're going to go to the gym and you're going to actually get stronger. You're going to have to take time. You're going to have to rest between your sets. You're going to have to put forth maximum effort. You're going to have to work. And then it's going to take time for it to pay off. And here, but that discipline, the discipline itself, there's pleasure in it. Right. And then there's a reward as you accumulate strength and growth over time. And there are so few things in our lives that discipline you to slow down and reflect on deep things.
Man, I was in such suspense over whether you're going to say smell the roses. I was like, is he going to do it? I hope he doesn't. I don't think he's going to. But will he say smell the roses?
No, I may be a cliche machine, but I'm not that hack.
Jake, I never said you were a cliche machine.
Yes, you did.
Well, not on mic. Okay, folks, since he said it, I'm just going to say, I think in written art, it is death to be a cliche machine. In spoken art, in rhetoric, it is oftentimes very great to be a cliche machine, to be able to summon cliches quickly and use them with facility. And Jake is good at that, which is one of the reasons he's our head pastor. And so when I did say it off mic, it was an observation / compliment without any sort of denigration in it, because it's actually a skill. Anyway, go ahead.
All I was saying is there's so few things in our lives. Everything is just instant gratification, even when it comes to mental exercises. It's like little games and things. And even as you get older, if you're like us, if you're in your 40s or close to it, as you get, a lot of people I know our age have such facility in their jobs. They're reaching the place where they're either going to get promoted beyond their competence, or they're just bored with their lives because the challenges aren't there anymore. They're really good at their jobs, and there's not even as much mental stimulation there anymore. So it's part of the midlife crisis is, what am I doing? And people wreck their lives, or they make big moves, take big risks, make big career changes, because they're looking for something to make them feel something. And a good literature is a good antidote to that sort of feeling, that we just say, hey, here's a place to just stop and be stretched and pushed, stop and slow down and reflect on life and meaning and memory and purpose and all these things that we sort of like, if we're just in constant forward motion, we never am moving from dopamine hit to dopamine hit to dopamine hit. We just never stop to deal with.
And so placing that kind of discipline in your life, that bar is not going to move unless you're strong enough to move it. That sentence isn't going to budge unless you've been working. And those thoughts aren't going to connect unless you've been doing the legwork. But it's really good. It's really nice. And part of the goodness of us stopping and doing this one, especially after doing as many short
39 little, steps.
Yeah, 39 steps, as many short little bursts as we've done. Even that, it just becomes part of the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. We love short novels. We're pro entertainment. We love all kinds of things. But yeah, I mean, I think the only other thought I have is, and this is not original with me, but I think I saw in preparing for this, I watched a YouTube video of one of the guy that wrote the book Living with Proust or something like that. And he says, the great thing about Proust is the great thing about any of the truly greats, which is they give you eyes to see the world with. And I think you think about J.K. Rowling, just to pick a random example out of the head, she doesn't give you eyes to see the world with. But there are a handful of people, like if you read a Jane Austen novel, you cannot help but walk away, go to your job the next day, and divide everyone into fools or wise or good or bad the way that Jane Austen does. You just can't help. Sometimes it can be a bad thing. Like sometimes the moral categories and the exactitude with which she lays them on is actually not helpful. But you can't help but read Jane Austen and do a little bit of that. Like, man, who do I know that's like Mr. Darcy and who do I know that's Mr. Wickham? Mostly a very good thing. Somebody like Tolstoy, you read Tolstoy and suddenly you want to see the world. You want to take a step back and observe your social surroundings with the kind of eye that he has. And Proust, similarly, I think, gives you a way of thinking about identity, of thinking about memory, of thinking about your past experiences, of thinking about your life, even of seeing the interplays between people, like the thing Ben was talking about with the guy that didn't want to admit the thing.
You know, even if you're thinking about poetry or a painting or something like that, a lot of good art doesn't even have to be all that profound. It's just enough to get you to see something again for the first time.
Yeah.
With fresh eyes, with eyes of wonder, where you've been calloused or jaded or whatever it is, that just takes away, gives you a filter or perspective on something that makes you stop and see the wonder and beauty of the world as God made it, or people, or the horror of it, the pain of it. All of those sorts of things.
Look at me, you know, like there's nothing more boring than going for a walk in the woods in Indiana. There also, if you've just read the Mirkwood chapter of The Hobbit, it's like Tolkien's given you everything that's horribly frightening and enticing and awe-inspiring about the forest. And so, yeah, it can just be things like that. Like a book can just put you back in touch with something that's primal that you becomes prosaic because you just see it every day. Mm-hmm. There's a section that Peter Jackson didn't bother to try to do because he's too much of a hack to probably even notice that it exists, where Frodo early on is just simply sitting under the stars and seeing these alien starscapes in Middle Earth. And reading that section gave me back the wonder of the stars. It's actually, I think, one of the reasons we turn to humanity turn to fantasy books is not because we are so in love with other worlds, but because we want to see our world again, and we need something to give it to us. Any other reflections upon the deeper meaning, Proust, gentlemen?
No, I don't think so.
All right. Well, there is deeper meaning in the making of money. One of the great deeper meanings in life is when you feel that sweet, hard cash pass from someone else's hand into yours, and then you put it in your wallet and you spend it. Whatever you want. The way that we do that on this podcast is through a system called Patreon. You can find at patreon.com/thebookthing. And that is the system whereby you give us money. And if you give us at least $10 a month, we will shout your name out in a little section called donor shoutouts. And that is what we are going to do right now. So gentlemen, reach deep inside your psyches and tell me what each one of these people makes you think about from your childhood. Starting with the artful Anthony Dodger and Bootstrap Betsy.
Pain.
Little Anthony's cigar store.
Joy.
The immortal Chelsea E.
Pain.
Jimmy Beam and Little Annie Oakley.
Joy.
And Ernesto the Lovebirds.
Pain.
The Keith Master.
Unconstrained sadness.
Jay and Katie, you are cold and love cheese and also see us lose, including till we have faces.
Pain.
DJ Sammy G.
Joy.
Benny and Danny Tiberius.
Pain.
Eric and Catherine from Beyond Window Breaks.
Friends I can never get back.
Lavender's Green Dylan Dylan.
Pain.
Noah Constrictor.
Joy.
Mary Cheap.
Pain.
Anthony, who is cold and hates life, liberty, and the pursuit of cheese.
Video games.
Jiu-Jitsu Jeffrey, the Texas Ranger.
Pain.
Midnight Ninja Ellen.
Joy.
Jay of Rack and Ruin.
Pain.
Eric and Kate, the Camp Champ Kings, who are warm and love bees.
Joy.
Sweet Jamie Sunshine.
Longing.
Gold Steel Cody.
Ice Cream.
John Bobadilla, Bomb Diggity, and Captain Daniel's Mate.
Pain.
Saxophone Alex.
Freeze Tag.
Ryan, the Terror of Texas, and Eric of the Cream and Crimson, who no longer are stuck in the cold, but please do send cheese.
Pain.
Ben Solo and Kylo Ren.
Joy.
John the Cosmic King of Chaos.
Pain.
Matty Matty Matman.
Joy.
Annie, are you okay? Get my gun. Get your gun.
Pain.
Thor Ragnar Josh.
Video games.
Lady of the Crystal Life. Or sorry, Lady of the Crystal Lake.
Pain.
Mysterious Phantom.
Unconstrained sadness.
Jeremy the Dark Hooded, Lord of Death, and his brooding bride, Maya.
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 Regret.
Remains of the J.
Joy.
Lamort de Trenton.
Pain.
And finally, Daniel, a man among men, and Jen, who strikes again every now and again. Then.
Hugs.
Hey, there you go. So Jake had some pain, a lot of pain, had some longing. And one other thing, what did you
regret?
Have? Regret, yes. I feel like I didn't have a lot of regret in my childhood. I was making a lot of regret for later. Ben had ice cream, video games, joy.
Freeze tag.
And lots of sadness.
Freeze tag, some sadness. A little bit sadness. Unconstrained sadness.
Yes. I remembered when Ben had a pristine moment, almost. It was there on the edge. When Ben said freeze tag, I remembered being 4 years old in my bedroom and being in bed at dusk or early dark and the kids outside my window all through the neighborhood playing flashlight tag and knocking on my window and trying to get me to come climb out the window and come play with them.
Nice.
Yeah, I remember that very vividly. Must have been 4. Might have been 5.
There you go.
That's pretty cool.
That is cool. My parents were still together. We're in a house on Glenmore Drive.
I will say, we forgot to say, the actual person moment when it comes is a little surprising because it's not what you think. It's actually him getting something, like him getting the whiff of something, like, oh, that kind of reminds me of something. And then he has to like
dig,
work for it.
Dig and deep. And
yeah, that's right.
Deep dive for it.
That's right.
And he like dredges up some and then he goes back down and dredges up. And it's a really interesting moment to read about, but it's not exactly the cultural understanding of a Proustian moment where it's just like you eat the ratatouille and then you have the moment. I guess the critic in Ratatouille is like the most famous modern Proustian moment depiction, come to think of it. Great moment from Ratatouille. And then the speech that he gives about criticism, total garbage. Bad hack writing on Brad Bird's part.
Brad Bird, not a hack director, but he has a thing about critics.
Who have been uniformly pleasant to him and love his stuff outside
except for Tomorrowland.
Yeah, but guys, critics are always going to exist.
You can't be making things and be bitter at critics.
Just depicting them as jerks who...
And I've not watched Tomorrowland, but it looks awfully hack. It looks awfully bad. It looks like it deserves to be... I'm sure it has... Because it's Brad Bird, I'm sure it has really great things, but...
It has great things. It's pretty evil ideologically. It's pretty irritating ideologically. And it is an ideologue's film, like all of Brad Bird's films. And so it's pretty annoying.
I think he made one masterpiece. I think The Incredibles is like a 10 out of 10.
Iron Giant.
Yeah, I love Iron Giant, but I think The Incredibles is like on Mount Rushmore with Citizen Kane. But I don't think anything else that he's done is quite that. I mean, Iron Giant's great. It would be the closest. And then Mission Impossible. Awfully fun.
I just have a lot of, like, okay, Incredibles was great. And it was great at its time. But it feels like, I don't know. Maybe it feels like it's been ruined.
By our 15-year pop culture obsession with superheroes.
Yeah, maybe. And part of the dumb thing about that movie is everybody who watches it comes away with
proto Ayn Rand kind of.
If everybody's special, nobody's special, and I'm that. Therefore, I am special. And I don't know.
No, you're not.
No, you're not. The whole point is that you're not.
Brad Bird.
You're not.
Brad Bird, clearly special. You.
Not.
Not.
Not. You're the dude who gets sucked into the propeller. Like.
Well, if you get better, you are. But you can also just accept that people are special.
And you're not.
And you're not. Which I think is a great
This is like, I don't know.
I get that people use Incredibles annoyingly. I don't know. I haven't watched it forever. Maybe it's the animation is certainly outdated. There's a little bit like Toy Story 1 or something where you're like, oh, this felt cooler at the time.
It was super cool.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, it was.
I think I would rather watch. Iron Giant's just kind of a little humorless for my tastes, I guess. Not that it needs to be, but it's just, I never want to watch Iron Giant. It's just too sad or something. I don't know.
That's got a lot of good laughs in it. It just gets in your memory overwhelmed by the sadness at the end.
Yeah, that's true. You know what the other thing I don't like about the Iron Giant is? I'll just as long as I'm saying, the blasphemy. Like, the movie has like some GDs and stuff, and it's just like, guys, yeah, you had a perfect movie. This was a 10 out of 10, and you made it a 9 out of 10. Just because
you wanted to be extra edgy, and you didn't have a Disney contract.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, we need Bob Iger in there saying, hey, guys, for the family. Disney, their famous family forward policies. Ben, how many Madeline tea cakes out of 433 do you give to the chunk that we've read of A la Recherche Roger?
I guess I give it 433. I don't see why not.
I don't even remember. Was that the number that was that?
Yeah,
the
that's full, what you gave. Yeah, it was full points.
Okay. Full points.
Jake, same question?
A 430. I dock it 3 Madelines because it would be so nice if he had a propulsive narrative to work with all this sort of. It's like what Tolstoy did with Anna Karenina, something that helped that enticed more readers to read it and pulled or pushed. We're not in the bottom tier of readers, and I think we've all had our moments where we've been.
I don't know that I can really dock it a Madeline for that, but.
Docked it 3 out of 433. So what's my percentage there?
It looks like you're about to tell me. Jake is entering the percentage. I'm going to put it at 99.
No, I'm going to put it like 0.85%.
It's 99.3%.
Huh.
99.3% points.
All right.
Or I docked it 0.7 points.
There you go. You docked it 0.7, so I didn't go down enough. Or, no, I went, anyway, I went too far.
All right. Well, I'm going to give it 0 Madelines. I don't need Fruity Frenchman telling me about his boring life. Who cares?
Sounds like a good take.
Utter garbage. Utter garbage. More like In Search of Lost Garbage.
More like In Search of a Waste of Time.
There you go.
More like In Search of a Waste Basket. To throw this book away.
Good job.
How's it done?
You improved on the metaphor.
Oh, I did.
Swan's way, more like wastebasket way. More like wastebasket trash.
Got him.
Oh, man. Yeah, you must be spinning in your grave.
Finally got taken down.
Finally gotcha.
By the bookening.
Proust. All right. Thanks for listening. We'll be back.